and welcome to another edition of Maplewood Barn Radio Theater, brought to you in conjunction with KBIA. Tonight's presentation by Stephen Leacock, first published in 1921, is a story told using the best models of romance novels of around 1875, parroting a style that was in vogue some 50 years before it was written. As your narrator, it is my duty to pop in every so often to make irreverent statements and offer irrelevant commentary. We begin with Chapter 1, Throne on the World, where we find our heroine, Winifred Clare, in a law office, wearing a deep mourning veil, being addressed by an old attorney.
Miss Winifred, you are this morning 21.
Yes.
This morning my guardianship of you is at an end.
There was a tone of something like emotion in the voice of the stern old lawyer, while for a moment his eye glistened with something like a tear, which he hastened to remove with something like a handkerchief.
I have therefore sent you to render you an account of my trust.
Did the bell ring?
I think it did. If your hearing does not improve, I shall be forced to buy a bigger bell. Be good enough, Atkinson, to fetch me the papers of the estate of the late Major Clare defunct.
Yes, I have them here, sir.
Thank you, Atkinson. That will be all for now. Miss Winifred, I will now proceed to give you an account of the disposition that has been made of your property. This first document refers to the sum of £2,000 left to you by your great uncle. It is lost.
Lost?
Yes, lost. Pray give me your best attention, and I will endeavor to explain how I lost it.
Oh, sir, I am only a poor girl, unskilled in the ways of the world, and know nothing but music and French. I fear that the details of business are beyond my grasp. But if it is lost, I gather that it is gone, Mr. Bonehead?
It is. I lost it in a marginal option call on an undeveloped oil company. I suppose that means nothing to you.
Alas, nothing.
Very good. Moving on, here we have a statement in regard to the £1,000 left to you under the will of your maternal grandmother. I lost it at Monte Carlo. But I need not fatigue you with the details.
Pray spare me.
With pleasure. Now, this final item relates to the sum of £1,500 placed in trust for you by your uncle. I lost it in a horse race. That horse ought to have won. He was coming down the stretch like a blue streak. But there, my dear, you must forgive me if the recollection of it still stirs me to anger. Suffice it to say that the horse fell. I have kept for your inspection the scorecard of the race and the betting tickets. You will find everything in order. I believe that is all.
Sir, I am but a poor, inadequate girl, a mere child in business. But tell me, I pray, what is left of me of the money that you have managed?
Nothing. Everything is gone. And I regret to say, Miss Clare, that it is my painful duty to convey to you a further disclosure of a distressing nature. It concerns your birth.
Good heavens! Does it concern my father?
It does, Miss Clare. Your father was not your father.
Oh, sir, my poor mother! How she must have suffered!
Your mother was not your mother.
Not my mother? But how—
Nay, do not question me. There is a dark secret about your birth.
Alas, Mr. Bonehead, I am then alone in the world and penniless?
You are, and it moves me deeply. You are unfortunately thrown upon the world. But if you ever find yourself in a position where you need help or advice, do not scruple to come to me, especially for advice. And meantime, let me ask you, in what way do you propose to earn your livelihood?
I can sew. I have my needle.
Let me see it.
Here it is.
I fear you will not be able to accomplish much with that. Atkinson, take Miss Clare out and throw her on the world.
Thank you.
Chapter 2, An Encounter. As Winifred Clare passed down the stairway, a figure appeared before her, blocking the way. The face, while entirely gentlemanly in its general aspect, was stamped with all the worst passions of mankind. This was Lord Winchgate, one of the most contemptible men in the city.
"Ha! Whom have we here? Stay, pretty one, and let me see the fair countenance that I divine behind your veil."
"Sir, let me pass, I pray."
"Not so, not till I have at least seen the color of those eyes and imprinted a kiss upon those fair lips."
"Let go of my wrist!"
With a brutal laugh,
ha ha ha,
he drew the struggling girl towards him. In another moment, the aristocratic villain would have succeeded in lifting the veil of the unhappy girl, when suddenly a ringing voice cried,
"Hold! Stop! Desist! Begone! Lay to! Cut it out!"
With these words, a tall, athletic young man leapt into the corridor from the street. His figure was that, more or less, of a Greek god, while his face, although at the moment inflamed with anger, was of an entirely moral and permissible configuration.
"Save me! Save me!"
"I will. He shall feel my cane."
But the cowardly aristocrat did not await the onslaught of the unknown stranger. He hissed in Winifred's ear,
"You shall yet be mine."
And releasing his grasp, he rushed into the street.
"Oh, sir, I fall upon my knees in gratitude. I am only a poor, inadequate girl. But if the prayers of one who can offer naught but her prayers to her benefactor can avail to the advantage of one who appears to have every conceivable advantage already, let him know that they are his."
"Nay, rise, kneel not to me, I beseech. If I have done aught to deserve the gratitude of one who, whoever she is, will remain forever present as a bright memory in the breast of one in whose breast such memories are all too few, he is all too richly repaid. If she does that, he is blessed indeed."
"She does. He is. Here on her knees she blesses him. And now we must part. Seek not to follow me. One who has aided a poor girl in the hour of need will respect her wish when she tells him that, alone and buffeted by the world, her one prayer is that he will leave her."
"He would. He will. He does."
"Leave me. Yes, leave me."
"Yes, I will."
Stay one moment more. Let she, who has received so much from her benefactor, at least know your name."
"He cannot. He must not. His birth is such. But enough. I must be gone."
He tore his hand from the girl's detaining clasp and rushed forward from the place. Winifred Clare was alone. Chapter 3, Friends in Distress. Winifred was now in the humblest lodgings in the humblest part of London. A simple bedroom and sitting room sufficed. Here she sat on her trunk, bravely planning for the future, when her landlady knocked.
"Miss Clare, do try to eat something. You must keep up your health. See, I've brought you a kippered herring."
"Thank you. Of all the landladies in London, you must be the kindest."
Winifred ate the herring, her heart filled with gratitude. With renewed strength, she sallied forth on the street to resume her vain search for employment. At various dressmaking establishments, she had offered to no purpose the services of her needle. They had looked at it and refused it. In vain, she had offered to various editors and publishers the use of her pen. They had examined it coldly and refused it. In vain, she had advertised in the newspapers offering to take sole charge of a little girl. No one would give her one. Each night, the unhappy girl returned to her lodging exhausted, with disappointment and fatigue. Yet, even in her adversity, she was not altogether friendless. Each evening on her return home, a soft tap was heard at the door.
"Miss Clare, I brought you a fried egg. Eat it. You must keep up your strength."
"Yes, dear landlady, so I must."
Then one morning, a terrible temptation had risen before her. She was contacted by the manager of an agency to which she had applied.
"Miss Clare, I'm glad to be able to make you a definite offer of employment. Are you prepared to go upon the stage?"
"The stage?"
A flush of shame and indignation swept over the girl. Had it come to this? Little versed in the world as Winifred was, she knew but all too well the degradation implied by the word.
"Yes, I have a letter here asking me to recommend a young lady of suitable refinement to play the part of Eliza on Uncle Tom's Cabin. Will you accept?"
"Sir, answer me first this question fairly. If I go upon the stage, can I, as Eliza, remain as innocent, as simple as I am now?
No, you cannot.
Then, sir, let me say this. Your offer is doubtless intended to be kind. Coming from the class you do, and inspired by the ideas you are, you no doubt mean well. But let a poor girl, friendless and alone, tell you that rather than accept such a degradation, she will die.
All right.
I go forth to perish.
Very good.
Winifred Clare, once more upon the street, sank down upon the steps of the building in a swoon. But at this very juncture, Providence, which always watches over the innocent and defenseless, was keeping its eye direct upon Winifred. A handsome equipage, drawn by two superb black steeds, happened to pass along the street. Its sides were emblazoned with escutcheons, insignia, and other paraphernalia, indicating at least the rank of marquis. The occupants of the equipage were two in number, a lady and gentleman, both of advanced years. Their snow-white hair and benign countenances indicated that they belonged to that rare class of beings to whom rank and wealth are but an incentive to nobler things. Those acquainted with the countenances of the aristocracy would have recognized at once the occupants of the equipage as the Marquis of Muddlenut and his spouse, the Marchioness. It was the eye of the Marchioness which first detected the form of Winifred Clare.
Hold! Pause! Stop! See, look! She has fainted! Quick, William, your flask! Let us hasten to her aid.
In another moment, the noble lady was bending over the prostrate form of Winifred and pouring brandy between her lips.
Where am I?
She speaks. Give her another flaskful.
Tell me, what has happened? Where am I?
With friends, but do not essay to speak. Drink this. You must husband your strength. Meantime, let us drive you to your home.
Winifred was lifted tenderly by the manservants into the aristocratic carriage. On the way, Winifred, at the solicitation of the Marchioness, related her story.
My poor child, how you must have suffered. Thank heaven it is over now. Tomorrow we shall call for you and bring you away with us to Muddlenut Chase.
Alas, could she but have known it, before the morrow should dawn, worse dangers still were in store. Four, a gambling party in St. James Close. We must now ask our listeners to shift the scene, if you don't mind doing this for us, to the apartments of the Earl of Winchgate in St. James Close. The hour is 9 o'clock in the evening, and the picture before us is one of revelry and dissipation, so characteristic of the nobility of England. The atmosphere of the room is thick with blue Havana smoke. On the green beige table is a litter of counters and cards. Seated above the table are six men dressed in the height of fashion, their faces stamped with all or nearly all of the baser passions of mankind. Lord Winchgate, for he it was who sat at the head of the table, rose with an oath,
"Drat!"
and flung his cards upon the table. All turned and looked at him with a series of oaths that shan't be repeated here.
Curse it, dogwood, drat. Take the money. I will play no more tonight. My luck has run out.
your mind is not on the cards. Who is the latest young beauty, pray, who so absorbs you? I hear a whisper in town of a certain misadventure of yours.
Dogwood, have a care, man, or you shall measure the length of my sword.
Both noblemen faced each other, their hands upon their swords. But at that moment, a distinguished-looking man in whose features the dignitaries of diplomatic circles would have recognized as the Marquis of Frogwater, British Ambassador to Siam, spoke.
My lords, let us have no quarreling. Come, Winchgate, come, Dogwood. Put up your swords. It is a shame to waste time in private quarreling. They may be needed all too soon in China, or for the matter of that, in Cambodia, or in Dutch Guinea.
Frogwater, you are right, and I am wrong. Winchgate, give me your hand.
Yes, shake hands, and let us all be convivial.
My friends, in asking you to abandon our game, I had an end in view. I ask your help in an affair of the heart.
Ha, excellent. We are with you, heart and soul. Aren't we, my companions?
Yes. I propose this night, with your help, to carry off a young girl, a female.
What? An abduction? Winchgate, I cannot countenance this.
Mistake me not. I intend to abduct her, but I propose nothing dishonorable. It is my firm resolve to offer her marriage.
Then I am with you.
Gentlemen, all is ready. The coach is below. I have provided masks, pistols, and black cloaks. Follow me.
Chapter 5. The Abduction. The hour was 9:40 when the carriage arrived. Winifred was seated, still fully dressed, at the window of the bedroom, looking out over the great city. A light tap came at the door.
If it's a fried egg, I do not need it. I ate yesterday.
No, you are wanted below.
I? Below?
You, below. A party of gentlemen have called for you.
Gentlemen? For me? At this late hour? Here? This evening? In this house?
Yes, 6 gentlemen. They arrived in a closed coach. They are all closely masked and heavily armed. They beg you will descend at once.
God in heaven! Is it possible that they mean to abduct me?
They do. They said so.
Alas, I am powerless. Tell them I will be down immediately. Let them not come up. Keep them below on any pretext. Show them an album of family photos. Let them look at the goldfish. Anything, but not here. I shall be ready in a moment.
As hastily as possible, she removed all traces of tears. She threw about her shoulders an opera cloak, and with a light Venetian scarf, half concealed the beauty of her hair and features. She murmured to herself,
"Abducted! And by 6 of them. I think she said 6. Oh, the horror of it!"
A touch of powder to her cheeks and a slight blackening of her eyebrows, and the courageous girl was ready. Lord Winchgate and his companions sat below in the sitting room, looking at the albums.
"Drat, woman, make her hurry up. We have seen enough of these pictures. We can wait no longer."
"I am here, my lords, for I divine who you are and wherefore you have come. Take me, do your worst with me. But spare, oh spare, this humble companion of my sorrow."
"We can do that, can't we, boys?"
"Enough! You will come with us, girl."
And seizing Winifred by the waist, he dragged her out upon the street. But something in the brutal violence of his behavior seemed to kindle a spark of manly feeling in the breasts of his companions.
"Winchgate, my mind misgives me. I doubt if this is a gentlemanly thing to do. I'll have no further hand in it."
"Nay, all you who feel compelled to cover your faces with masks, go forward with your fell design. I am here. I am helpless. Let no prayer stay your hand. Go to it."
"Have done with this. Shove her in the coach."
But at that very moment, as the sound of hurrying footsteps was heard, a clear, ringing, manly, well-toned, vibrating voice cried,
"Hold! Stop! Desist! Have a care, titled villain, or I will strike you to the earth!"
A tall, aristocratic form bounded out of the darkness.
"Gentlemen, we are betrayed. Save yourselves! To the coach!"
In another instant, the 6 noblemen had leaped into the coach and disappeared down the street. Winifred saw before her the unknown stranger who had earlier stood between her and disaster. She fell swooning into his arms.
"Dear lady, rouse yourself. You are safe. Let me restore you to your home."
"That voice! It is my benefactor!"
She would have swooned again, but the unknown lifted her bodily up the steps of her home and leaned her against the door.
"Farewell."
"Oh, sir, let one who owes so much to one who has saved her in her hour of need at least know his name."
But the stranger, with a mournful gesture of farewell, had disappeared as rapidly as he had come. Chapter 6. The Unknown. The scene is now shifted sideways and forwards, so as to put it at Muddlenut Chase, and to make it a fortnight later. Winifred is now at the Chase as the guest of the Marquis and the Marchioness. There her bruised soul finds peace. The Chase itself was one of those typical country homes which are, or were still yesterday, the glory of England. The approach to the Chase lay through 10 miles of glorious forest, filled with fallow deer and wild bulls. The house itself, dating from the time of the Plantagenets, was surrounded by a moat covered with broad lilies and floating green scum. Here sat Winifred Clare day after day, recovering her strength under the tender solicitude of the Marchioness.
In sooth, I must leave soon, Marchioness. I have been such an imposition on your household.
Nay, stay where you are. Your soul is bruised. You must rest.
Alas, who am I that I should rest? Alone, despised, buffeted by fate? What right have I to your kindness?
Miss Clare, there is something that I wish to say to you. Winifred, if I may so call you, Lord Muddlenut and I have formed a plan for your future. It is our dearest wish that you should marry our son.
Alas, it cannot be.
Say not so. Our son, Lord Mordaunt Muddlenut, is young, handsome, all that a girl could desire. After months of wandering, he returned to us this morning. It is our dearest wish to see him married and established. We offer you his hand.
Indeed, I seem to requite but ill the kindness that you show. Alas, my heart is no longer in my keeping.
Where is it?
It is another's.
But at this very moment a blithe, gladsome step was heard upon the flagstones of the terrace. A manly, ringing voice, which sent a thrill to Winifred's heart, cried,
Mother!
And in another instant, Lord Mordaunt Muddlenut, for he it was, had folded the Marchioness to his heart. Winifred rose, her heart beating wildly. One glance was enough. The newcomer, Lord Mordaunt, was none other than the unknown. With a wild cry, Winifred Clare leaped across the flagstones of the terrace and fled into the park. Chapter 7. The Proposal. They stood beneath the great trees of the ancestral park, into which Lord Mordaunt had followed Winifred in a single bound. All about them was the radiance of early June. Lord Mordaunt knelt on one knee on the greensward, and with a touch in which respect and reverence were mingled with the deepest and manliest emotion, took between his finger and thumb the tip of the girl's gloved hand.
Miss Clare, Winifred, hear me, I implore.
Alas, alas, whither can I fly? I do not know my way through the wood, and there are bulls in all directions. I am not used to them. Lord Mordaunt, I implore you, let the tears of one but little skilled in the art of dissimulation—
Nay, Winifred, fly not. Hear me out.
Let me fly.
You must not fly. Let me first, here upon bended knee, convey to you the expression of a devotion, a love as ardent and as deep as ever burned in a human heart. Winifred, be my bride.
Oh, sir, if the knowledge of a gratitude, a thankfulness from one whose heart will ever treasure as its proudest moment the recollection of one who did for one all that one could have wanted done for one, if this be some poor reward, let it suffice. But alas, my birth, the dark secret of my birth, forbids—
Nay, your birth is all right. I have looked into it myself. It is all good, or nearly as good, as my own. Till I knew this, my lips were sealed by duty. While I supposed that you had a lower birth and I'm upper, I was bound to silence. But come with me to the house. There is one arrived with me who will explain all.
Hand in hand, the lovers returned to the Chase. The Marquis and Marchioness were standing ready to greet them.
My sweet child, Winifred, it is time she knew all, son.
Lord Mordaunt stepped across the room to a curtain. He drew it aside, and there stepped forward Mr. Bonehead, the old lawyer.
Miss Clare, the time has come for me to explain all. You are not, you never were, the penniless girl that you suppose. Under the terms of your father's will, I was called upon to act a part and throw you upon the world. It was my client's wish, and I followed it. I had told you quite truthfully that I had put part of your money into options in an oil well. Miss Clare, that well is now producing 1,000,000 gallons of gasoline a month.
1,000,000 gallons? I could never use that much.
It is not for you to use, Miss Winifred, but to sell.
Then I am rich?
Rich beyond your dreams, Miss Clare. You personally own about half the state of Texas. I think it is in Texas, at any rate, either Texas or New Hampshire, one of those big states in America. More than this, I have invested your property since your father's death so wisely that even after paying the income tax and the property tax, the inheritance tax, the dog tax, and the carpet tax, you will still have 0.5% to spend.
Oh, that is wonderful, Mr. Bonehead.
I knew it all the time. I found it out through this good man.
We knew it, too. Can you forgive us, darling, for our little plot? Had we not done this, Mordaunt might have had to follow you over to America and chase you all around Newport and Narragansett at a fearful expense.
How can I thank you enough? And my birth, my descent?
It is all right. It is A1, in fact. Your father, who died before you were born, years and years before, belonged to the very highest peerage of Wales. You are descended directly from Clare Ap Clare, who murdered Owen Glendower. Your mother we are still tracing up, but we have already connected her with Floyd Ap Floyd, who murdered Prince Llewellyn.
Oh, sir, I only hope I may prove worthy of them.
One thing more.
And stepping over to another curtain, he drew it aside, and there emerged Lord Winchgate. He stood before Winifred, a manly contrition struggling upon his features.
Miss Clare, I ask your pardon. I tried to carry you off. I never will again. But before we part, let me say that my acquaintance with you has made me a better man, broader, bigger, and I hope, deeper.
With a profound bow, Lord Winchgate took his leave. Chapter 8. Wedded at Last. Lord Mordaunt and his bride were married in the parish church of Muddlenut Chase. With Winifred's money, they have drained the moat, rebuilt the chase, and herded the bulls out of the park. They have 6 children so far, and are respected, honored, and revered in the countryside far and wide over a radius of at least 10 miles. We hope you've enjoyed this retelling of Stephen Leacock's Winnie the Winsome or Trial and Temptation, presented by the Maplewood Barn Radio Players. Our performers for this show were Chelsea Christian as Winnie, Jason Christian as the lawyer, Joe Bogue as Winchgate, Ian Buchanan was the stranger, Lord Mordaunt, Angela Howard Lechtenberg appeared as the landlady and the marchioness, Michael Tooley was the agent and Frogwater, and Darren Helwidge, who also engineered the recording, was the clerk and Dogwood. Winsome Winnie was adapted for radio by Brad Buchanan, and post-production was done by Amy Humphrey and Joe Hayes of the band Clatter. This is your narrator, Byron Scott, hoping you will join us again at the same time next week for another classic story, right here on KBIA.